Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS9. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is personal finance expert Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, will it be ciao from Italy? Why political turmoil in the Eurozone's third biggest economy has the market spooked, and why we should care. Also, what can you do to stop your dream house move falling through? In troubled times for the high street, we take a look at one retailer bucking the trend, plus moves to make tax simpler. Will they work? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
But first, last week on the show it was Ponzi. This week we focus on another rather unwelcome Italian export, that is their turbulent politics. It's got investors and the Eurozone spooked that we could soon get an Itexit. Can we call it? No, we can't call it that. It's as the bloc's third largest economy finds itself embroiled in a power struggle between Eurosceptic populists, winners of the March election, and the pro-EU establishment, now the ramifications of which has spread across the globe. So what is going on in Italy? How have we got here? Where are we going? And why should we care? So, a very warm welcome to you both. Simon, to you first, if that's all right. Elections in March, yet no government. Calls for the president to be impeached. Italy, just a colony of Germany. What's going on?
Actually, initially, the reaction to the election in March that didn't deliver a decisive result, but delivered a big share of the vote for these two populist parties, one of which is called the Five Star Movement and is an anti-establishment party, considered to be on the left, but I don't know whether it really does conform to the traditional ideas of left wing. You know, it's very much anti-austerity. It wants to try and completely overthrow what they call the corrupt political class in Italy. And the League, which is a right-wing party, used to be called the Northern League. These two parties got the most of the vote, but there was no decisive winner. So since March, negotiations have been going on to decide who on earth is going to be in charge of Italy. And everyone pretty much took that one in their stride, really, because if there is one thing that Italy is good at, it is political chaos. But what they did eventually decide was that they both had a shared distaste for the Italian establishment and a pretty much a shared distaste for the European establishment. However, neither of them did actually specifically run on an anti-euro ticket. But they came to an agreement that they would go into coalition. But what they were going to need to do in order to do this was have a prime minister. So after a lot of discussions, they finally decided on a prime minister that they could agree with, who was a man called Giuseppe Conte. However, they also wanted to have a finance minister, Paolo Savona. Now, the weird thing about the prime minister was essentially he was not someone who was really from either party, because he couldn't be, and he wasn't really anyone with any political background. And when he was in negotiations with anyone, can you imagine if he went off to negotiate with the other European leaders? Before he could really agree to anything, he was going to have to go back and say to the parties he was representing, well, what do you think? So it was a bit of a weird situation. But what was considered slightly more weird was the appointment of a Eurosceptic finance minister, Paolo Savona, 81-year-old, whose main crime in the past appeared to have been criticising the Germans in terms of their running of the euro and the eurozone, also saying that Italy should have a plan B for leaving the euro. I mean, some of that...
You wouldn't be the first person to have said either of those things, I imagine.
There's a lot of people who might think that actually having a plan B to leave the euro just might be common sense. However, the euro was constructed with no way of leaving it. It's like the Hotel California of currencies, unfortunately, which is one of the things behind the whole mess that we had with Greece. So anyway, to cut the long story a little bit shorter, just as this whole thing was about to be rubber stamped, the Italian president, Sergio Mattarella, decided that he could not possibly countenance the appointment of Signor Savona. And so he vetoed it. And he said, the uncertainty over our position has alarmed investors and savers both in Italy and abroad. And he alluded to a belief that by putting Savona in, the two parties were trying to sneak in an anti-euro agenda. And he added, membership of the euro is a fundamental choice. If we want to discuss it, then we should do so in a serious fashion. This meant that Conte was not going to become prime minister anymore because they refused to come up with another finance minister. And he was been replaced by an emergency stopgap, who is a man called Carlo Cottarelli. And he's an ex-International Monetary Fund official.
But that's gone down well.
Yeah. I mean, so basically, you can't have this guy. You're angry.
Mm.
Lots of people in Italy are angry at the Eurozone and at the Euro. They don't think it's played out very well for them over the last 20 years. Arguably, it hasn't. But just stoking that a little bit more, you block the appointment of a Eurosceptic finance minister, and then you put someone who used to work for the IMF in charge for a bit. So anyway, obviously, it all kicked off. The Eurozone crisis is back with a vengeance. Italian bond yields rocketed above 3%. Everyone's gone a bit, ooh.
Everyone has gone a bit, ooh. We'll go into the bond yields because I want you to do a bit of economics 101 into why this all matters. But Rachel, there is speculation that we could get a fresh election as early as, I think it's July or August time. The problem I imagine going into it was the two parties were voted because the public have probably had enough of the Eurozone or an anti-establishment kind of vote. They've got this situation that Simon's beautifully described. So I imagine if those people then go back to the polls, well, that's just going to shore up that vote for the anti-establishment, anti-EU. So we're going to be almost in a worse situation.
Precisely. So the first vote wasn't really about Europe at all. But now it's stoked all of that up again. It could well be. And that's what Europe's going to be worried about. Italy, as the third largest economy in the Eurozone, has a lot of power. If it starts to rock the boat, then that's big waves for Europe.
And of course, these are two parties that have promised to spend a fair amount more on pensions and social care and all those things which cost a lot of money. And Italy doesn't have a huge amount of money. Is that fair?
Well,
a big economy, but they're spending a lot.
The Italian economic situation is quite complicated. So you have a much more prosperous north and a much less prosperous south. It's even more geographically imbalanced than the UK, for example. You have the issue of decades of corruption. I don't think many Italians would argue with that. But you also have a lot of debt. A lot of public sector debt, 132% of GDP, which is a very big number. And in order to pay that down, you need to get some good growth so that you can pay it down. Or what you could have done in the past is got a load of inflation in, devalued your currency, because you'd be paying it in lira. You could do that like we can in the UK with the pound. The fall in the pound did us a huge benefit in terms of getting some growth in, making our stuff cheaper for other people to buy, gives you a bit of extra growth, try and pay down that debt. Italy doesn't have that choice.
Mm-hmm.
But whilst it has a large public sector net debt, it actually runs something called a primary surplus, which means that before its interest payments, it actually makes a surplus. It more than balances its books. Of course, what then chucks an extra spanner into the works compared to 5 years ago, for example, when the five-star movement first rose to prominence, and I first wrote the question in my column of could Italy be the first country out of the euro, is that the borrowing costs are very low now, and that's been driven by the European bond buying program, which has basically bought up all these government bonds and driven down the costs. But the problem for ordinary everyday Italians is that disposable income per capita is below where it was when they started the eurozone. There's 31.5% youth unemployment, and there's all kinds of other problems, and they just don't see membership of the euro working for them. There's not a huge movement to get out of it, but there's a growing feeling that they don't like it. And that's the problem with this idea of a new election, is I think the European leaders think that if Italy has another election, they'll come to their senses and realise quite how disastrous it would be for them economically to leave the euro and why they shouldn't press the big red button. But what you will get is potentially more anti-euro stoking, and people might just decide to press the big red button because people decided to do that when we had the Brexit vote.
And the sky never fell in just yet with the Brexit vote. What's the big issue? Why is everybody up in arms around the globe? Asian stock markets falling? Rachel, why does anybody care? Let Italy do what they want.
It's not hugely dramatic. I mean, thinking about when we used to talk about crisis in the Eurozone, I mean, the good old days when a crisis was a real crisis. And we used to check the 10-year government bond rates for different countries, and the magic numbers to look for were around about 6-7%. That's when you know a country could go bust. And the headlines this week have been Italy's bond rates up past 3%. So it's not quite the levels that we saw before, but there's contagion in that, I guess, the size of the Italian economy, but more importantly, the implications for the rest of Europe and whether it will spread. But it hasn't been to the extent that I think if there was real fear, Italy might end up out of the Eurozone. It wouldn't just be Italy's bonds that would be suffering. It would be any other country that has had a portmanteaued exit attached to their name, Grexit. We'd be looking at Greek bonds and they would be suffering. We'd be looking at other big Eurozone countries and they'd be suffering. And that has not happened. So it's sort of somewhere in between. I think, yes, things are moving about a bit. And we had a 1.3% drop in the FTSE, which sounds much better if you call it a £25 billion wipe off the size of British blue chip shares. So a bit, but not to the extent that we've seen in the past, and not to the extent that I think people genuinely think that there's risk, a serious risk to the Eurozone.
Economics 101, though, wind back a little bit to bonds. What does that even mean? What you just said then, what does it mean in layman's terms? For anyone listening who doesn't quite get it.
Bonds are just debt that are issued by governments. For some reason, government debt gets its own special name in different countries. It might be gilts or whatever, but we call them bonds. And how much a country has to pay investors to take on their debt depends on how likely investors think that country is to pay back the debt. So if they think that the economy is very strong and the government is secure, then probably you're not going to have to pay investors very much money to take on a bit of your debt. Once you get a little bit more worried that a government could face problems, or perhaps levels of debt get so high that a country might find it difficult to pay back, then it gets more expensive. And so that's why, for example, Italian bonds will have gone up past 3%. But then in the case of the Eurozone, there's another little dimension to this, which is each country is no longer supposed to fend for itself. You also have the support of the Eurozone. So the pricing of bonds will depend on, one, what we think the state of an individual country's economy is, but two, how much support it is and is likely to continue receiving from the Eurozone. So will it be bailed out, or is the Eurozone going to continue buying up that debt if necessary? So the pricing is a little bit more obscure than it once was.
Simon, who is holding this all together? Maybe I'm conflating two issues here between the EU and the Eurozone, but especially with regards to the EU, we had George Soros, the billionaire, coming out, the anti-Brexit billionaire, I should point out, coming out and saying, you know, the EU's facing existential crisis, etc., etc. And the Eurozone, well, we've been talking about this for a long time, haven't we? And we've talked about Greece today. Who is actually holding these together? Shouldn't we just let the whole thing fall apart? Or is it working for someone? Because with all the stories at the moment, I can't see who they're working for.
Well, I guess the whole thing is being held together by the Germans, really. You know, they don't hold the purse strings technically, but they're the ones with all the money. So France and Germany are the most powerful countries within the EU. And it's very much seen as the Germans dictating terms to everybody else. And the Germans like to be prudent. And they don't like people to get off debts that they have run up, because that's not prudent. So the problem that you have is these countries have such disparate economies. You know, this is going back to the whole Eurozone crisis involving Greece. Is the Eurozone put together all of these countries, but they have very, very different economies. Can you run a currency union that has Germany in it and Greece in it? Can you run one that has Germany in it and Italy in it? Well, yes, you probably can, but what you then probably have to do is start sharing responsibility more. And that means proper banking union, so that instead of each individual country standing behind its banks, the Eurozone stands behind its banks. It means a bond union. It means that instead of Italy issuing bonds and Germany issuing bonds and Greece issuing bonds, maybe it should be the Eurozone that's issuing bonds and the Eurozone stands behind those bonds. But the problem with that, of course, is that then where does the borrowing level go? Does it go at the high level of the Greece or the low level of Germany or somewhere in the middle? And Germany suffers because then it has to pay a bit more. And so you've got this problem where you've got this idea of a union, but people who don't want to pay more to help other people, they don't want to have the transference of money that you probably essentially need from the rich parts of the currency union to the poor parts of the currency union and to be constantly supporting those people. And this is probably the fundamental flaw with the Eurozone. If you want to have this thing, you have to have much more of a collective standing together. And also probably the other flaw was when they created the Euro, you can join the Euro, but you can't leave the Euro. There is no official process for leaving the Euro. So then it creates this will they, won't they kind of scenario where it's a situation of, well, their borrowing costs are going up because they might default on it, but they can't default on it without leaving the Euro. So could they ever really default? And so it creates this whole unholy mess. And the reason why, obviously, this is so much more important than Brexit is because we don't share a currency with the rest of Europe.
So it could work, is essentially what you're saying. It just isn't right now. And what I want to know, is it a case of, you know, you said Germany don't want this to fall, obviously. Is it a case of there's more to lose than there is to gain? So actually, is anybody gaining anything? They just don't want to lose out.
I think that you would see a lot of schadenfreude in this country with people borrowing a German term were the euro to be sunk or a country to leave the euro. However, I think it would be misplaced because I think the collapse of the euro would be very, very bad news for the global financial system. And funnily enough, there is a country that plays a major role in the global financial system, and it is Britain. So we would really suffer as well. I think the real problem is that 5 years after we were kind of last talking about this problem, there's been a load of cheap money thrown at it in the form of slashing interest rates and quantitative easing, bond buying programs and things like that. But a lot of it's just been kicking the can down the road and treating the symptoms, not the cause. The problems in Italy have been blindingly obvious to anybody who bothered to look. The rise of these populist parties has been blindingly obvious. And the Eurozone leaders, you know, they get branded this Euro elite, really haven't given the perception that they're working to help Italy and, more importantly, the Italian people. It makes it look like they are more concerned with benefiting the euro as a concept than the Europeans who live under it and spend it. And I think you can draw a line between that and the fact that since the Brexit vote, what has appeared to be the case to people, maybe different behind the scenes, is that rather than wanting to negotiate a mutually beneficial situation where for Britain and the EU there appears to be this desire that we have to be seen to be punished because, you know, pour encourager les autres, so that, you know, the others don't try and do it as well. And I think the European leaders need to, if they want this thing to continue, if they want the Eurozone to succeed, if they want the EU to succeed, they have to have a complete change in their mindset of how they think about these things.
Final word to you, Rachel, and bonus points if it's a foreign word that isn't, what have we used so far, Italian, German and French, so you can throw in a bit of Spanish, some Greek, you know, whatever you want, but final word to you on this one. Where now for this?
I think we just kick it further down la rue.
French is taken.
oh, that's my home. What are you whispering, Simon?
Manana.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. I was just thinking, it's like trying to have a giant day out with a load of people and everyone wants to do different things and everyone's got different budgets, but you think, do you know what? Wouldn't it be nice if just all 27, however many of us there are, we could all just go out and have a giant old picnic together? But they've got different budgets, they want different things, and everyone's going a bit chaotic and thinking, wouldn't it just be better if we could just go and do our own little thing again? And so then what do you say? You say, no, you can't leave the picnic. Because that's the only way to do it, to make it absolutely inconceivable. And maybe once the originators of the giant idealist vision of the grand day out together leave, die off, whatever, everyone will sort of think, why are we here again? What were we doing?
Yamas, I'll say to that. Now something that's cheers, by the way, I think in Greek, but if it's not, then I apologise. Now to something closer to home, literally, and something I'm sure many of our listeners have or are going through. Now, you've received a letter from a reader who's in the process of selling their flat, and they have been for the last 6 months. Now, they say after a number of false starts have cost them several £1,000 in wasted legal fees, they're now really worried that the house they've had an offer accepted on is going to drop them because they're holding them back from making their own move. Now, they say, I'm at my wit's end, though. My estate agent doesn't seem to be able to find me a buyer that is committed, and I'm running out of time on the house I want to buy. What are my options? Now, this is a pretty common problem. 1 in 3 home sales in the UK falling through. So what can they do? Rachel, just briefly, why do so many home sales fall through? 1 in 3?
Oh, there's all sorts of reasons, aren't there? I mean, one is that you get chains, and so it only gets one thing to be scuppered for a whole chain of sales not to go through. So one person doesn't get the financing that they want, or one person at the last minute decides actually going to get divorced instead or whatever it is, or move to Bermuda, and then a whole chain does. It can be individual circumstances. It can be a buyer will have a survey done on a place and decide actually they don't want to take on a leaking roof or whatever the problem is with the home. Lots of different reasons, but they can often essentially multiply because of the chains.
Simon, what are the options then for this reader and for anyone else who might be in this situation at the moment? Because it must be so stressful.
Yes, it is. And I mean, the difficulty is, in this particular question, we're talking about someone who has found a house that they want to buy but can't sell their own one. Now, the first option, of course, is to simply drop your price until you get someone to buy it from you. The biggest barrier to selling your home is usually your refusal to accept a lower price for it. Unfortunately, people do two things. They anchor on what they think the price of their house is worth, perhaps what one sold for down the road, or what the original asking price was, or what an estate agent told them they could have got a year ago. And if it suddenly comes to it selling for 20, 30, 40, 50,000 pounds less than that, they think that they've lost 20, 30, 40, 50,000 pounds. They actually haven't technically lost anything. They've lost the opportunity to have previously sold at a higher price, but would they have really sold at a higher price? Asking prices mean nothing. Anybody can put their house up for sale for anything they want. So you could drop the price. But the problem with that is that if you want to buy somewhere, then normally in people's mind, it's like, how do I get this deal together? I need to have this amount of money to buy that property. Now, if the person above you really wants to sell, they might accept less money. You could just go to them and say, I can't sell my place, but I could sell it for £20,000 less. Will you accept £20,000 less of me? And then I'll definitely buy yours. Some people will do that. So the first thing I would say is think about the price and think about negotiating on it. Think about going up the chain and saying to those people, will you sell to me for less so that I can definitely buy your home? Because those people, if they put their house back on the market now, might not get what you offered them previously.
Can you go to an estate agent who's selling your house and say, give me a really realistic figure? So
yes.
When I do go and look, we can put it on for whatever we want and try and get that extra 50k, but so that in my head, when I'm going to buy somewhere, I know realistically what I should get.
If you get an estate agent to come around and value your property, what you want from them is 3 figures. You don't want 1 figure. You want, what could I sell it for quickly if I put it on the market tomorrow? What could I sell it for if I tidied it up a bit and did all those things that I think I need to do? For example, you know, just redecorate some rooms and everything. And I was willing to wait a little bit, but I do still want to definitely move. And what could I sell it for if I put it on and I'm just willing to wait for the best price? Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the third one of those is going to mean you waiting a lot longer. So you're going to have to be a lot more realistic about finding a property that you really want. The other options that have been given in here is use another agent. You could put it on with multiple agents. It relists it, it freshens it up. That's a lot harder nowadays, though, because you rely much less on people's branches, people's mailing lists, the old adverts that you used to see in the local newspaper. Mm. Everybody goes on to Rightmove or Zoopla, so people will probably have already seen your home. So listing it with another agent might not necessarily help. And actually, buyers aren't that keen on homes that are listed with a load of estate agents. They think, what's wrong with that? A bridging loan, this is a very expensive form of finance that can lend you the money to buy the new place while you're still waiting to sell your existing one. I would strongly advise against doing this unless there is some real compulsion to do it, because the interest rates are huge and you can just end up running up very big charges. Use a home buying service. These are people who offer to buy, we buy any home type thing,
yeah.
Like we buy any car. But they will pay you less than your house is worth. They'll pay you less than fair market value. Then there is this other service, and actually we got this guy to help answer this question, who's a chap who runs a service called Nested, which is a bit of a strange service, to be honest. It's an estate agent that allows you to withdraw money from your home if and when you need it. So you agree a deal with them of the amount of money that you can get from your home. They lend you the money interest-free for up to a year, which you could then treat as being under offer. If they sell your home, obviously you just get the money.
Mm-hmm.
If at the end of the year your home isn't sold, you can then withdraw the advance from them to complete the purchase, and they'll continue to market your home and pay you the rest of the money when it sells. I don't know whether this is a good service to sign up for. You know, I to me, the idea of you're either just going to have to be patient or cut the price on your property seems like the most realistic one, because that's the one that doesn't involve engaging another middleman.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Now, despite some more positive news from the High Street last month, the troubles continue nonetheless, so it's rather refreshing to read a good news story, and it comes in the form of B&M. Now, they're the budget retailer. They saw annual profits rise over 25% to £229.3 million, and in the year ending the 31st of March, the group's revenues increased by 22% to £3 billion. So, good news for B&M. Bad news, Rachel, I guess, as it sort of shows that perhaps we're turning more to budget stores for the essentials, or am I just being a bit pessimistic here and turning to budget stores for essentials is a good thing that everyone should do?
Why not pay the least for something that you can do? But I think this is
who are B&M, I should point out.
It's a new retail. I think there's more of them in the north than in the south, and they sell kind of, as you say, essentials. But I went to one. A lot of what they sell is kind of, I think, borderline discretionary essential. So things that it's quite nice to have and you can justify as being something that you probably need to have in your home, but you could probably do without. But the reason why I think they get away with that is they're cheap. So you might go in to stock up on, say, cleaning products, and then they're selling quite a nice barbecue for $59.99, and you think, well,
who doesn't need a barbecue?
I sort of need a barbecue now I think about it, for the 3 days of summer that we'll have this year, and you start to imagine the possibilities and the people you might have around and the fun that you'll have, and suddenly, yes, you need that barbecue. And if you can have that barbecue, you probably need that outdoor furniture as well, and they'll, throughout the year, they'll have those things that I think kind of, yeah, fit in that grey area, justifiable, but not quite essential, but still cheap.
So this might be, Simon, why they're doing so well. Is there another reason why perhaps they're doing so well?
No, I mean, it's a massive opportunity for me, because I am a man who needs a barbecue, needs some garden furniture, yeah, and needs a bench. So I should probably get myself down to B&M and I could buy some cheap baked beans at the same time.
Nice.
I actually don't like baked beans and don't want any baked beans and don't need any baked beans. But no, the B&M chief executive, Simon Arora, said it wanted to replicate Aldi and Lidl's success in the non-food sector. He said, "We want to be to homeware, DIY, toys and stationery what Aldi and Lidl have been to the grocery sector." And he said shoppers in the southeast are more likely to splash out £100 on some patio furniture. But he said, "Our stores in the southeast are actually more profitable on average than the rest of the country. And it's due to that reason." But it's also due to the fact that they stock a lesser selection of goods. So it's more like Aldi and Lidl, in that instead of having a gazillion different kinds of toothpaste, there's just fewer kinds of toothpaste, fewer kinds of breakfast cereal, things like that. That appears to appeal to people who got very much fed up of the huge big box out-of-town supermarkets. And I guess they just don't have the same legacy costs. And I looked at the numbers earlier. Tesco, most recent results, £57.5 billion of revenue, £1.3 billion of profit. B&M, on the other hand, was £3 billion of revenue and £229 million of profit. And just to put that in context, Tesco's revenues are 19 times bigger than B&M's, but its profits are only 5.7 times bigger than B&M's. And that indicates that B&M is just making more money on every pound that it pulls in through the door due to things like stocking less stuff, less legacy costs, and Britain's insatiable desire for barbecues and garden furniture.
Which is funny, because you had the recent case of Homebase, didn't you? Which, yeah, absolute disaster situation there. And I would have imagined it, at a time when we've got a financial crisis or the vestiges of, you know, people perhaps less likely to move a little bit more, wanting to do up their home. I was surprised that that would be the case, that a DIY company wouldn't do so well if it was just that issue.
Yes. It is actually quite surprising. You know, home transactions aren't down that much. And first-time buyer numbers are up. And first-time buyers are big purchasers of DIY stuff, garden furniture and things like that. And I think it's to do with the fact that these shops just aren't particularly lean and they're suffering from the internet. So that means that they suffer more from the internet purchasing scenario and people's ability to compare costs. And I think the difference between them and B&M is B&M sells people stuff when they want it. So they have a section of the shop dedicated to this stuff. At the beginning of summer, they get in some summer stuff, they sell it to people, and if it sells really well, they get some more of it in, and they continue to sell it. If it doesn't sell very well, they've only bought a small amount of stock, and then they discount it and get shot of it as quickly as they can. And then when it rolls round to the next season, they do that. And it's just, I think it's the age-old art of selling people stuff that they want to buy when they want to buy it. Whereas if you go into the B&Qs and Homebases of this world, they've got discounted garden furniture in there all year round, haven't they?
That's true.
You know, they don't seem to shift all of it in summer. They seem to have bought too much stock, and that's got to cost them a lot of money.
Rachel, we've been predicting the demise of the high street for yonkies years, haven't we? Are we right this time?
Well, I mean, definitely there are these silver linings, places like B&M. It's just about finding things that people want that they can't get on the internet. And I think B&M kind of fits into that category. It's part of the experience. You don't quite know, because it is seasonal. You don't know what you're going to get. And so it's always a bit interesting. The thing I wonder about is how sustainable that is for any one brand and how you keep up that sort of level of curiosity. I wonder whether it kind of fits into a similar pattern of, you know how they say that lipstick sales always go up during recessions? Mm-hmm. People still like their treat. And B&M is kind of, for me, I think it's in that kind of context, affordable luxury that's justifiable. How long you can retain that and stay in that category before the next thing comes along that, you know, your neighbour tells you, oh, have you been to places like Tiger? The same thing. You go in and you don't know what you're going to find. It's quite fun, and you can just about afford to, you know, that's only £2. You can have one of those, and that's only £1. And you go out and you've spent £9 on things that you didn't really need to buy all that ribbon, but what, you know, what the hell? How long a single shop brand can keep that up for, and how much space there is on the high street for that type of thing and other sort of shops with differences that keep people engaged and interested so that they don't just buy it online.
It's interesting you say that. You say engaged, interested, fun. I suppose it's about the experience, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think also the key to it is getting hold of decent quality stuff that you can sell at a good price. So if you can get hold of decent quality, unbranded barbecues, that means that you can sell them for a good price. Then when those people come into the shop and they see that barbecue, that's what you can't get from the internet. They like to see the whites of the barbecue's eyes. You know, they want to see that barbecue. They want to, like, right,
feel
is this
it,
any good?
Themselves
is this 50
it?
Quid barbecue a bargain or a piece of rubbish that's going to fall apart within 1 year? And if you can see it and you know that that barbecue is good and it's 50 quid, then you might buy that. So maybe on the internet, you're more likely to go buy your Weber barbecue on the internet and compare your prices, because you know that's going to be a certain amount of quality. Whereas with the garden, with furniture, you know, the bench, the barbecue, it's a lot more of a lucky dip if you just go buy that off Amazon. And it's going to be a lot harder to send that back as well. So maybe that's where this, maybe that's the key to success, maintaining it.
Maybe. Finally, though, tax doesn't need to be taxing. So we're always led to believe by those helpful HMRC adverts reminding us to pay our income tax on time. And maybe it doesn't, but But it is. So much so, we have the delightfully named Office of Tax Simplification. And now they've released a new report on the current tax system for saving. Among the suggestions, ISA rules should be relaxed to make moving savings and opening numerous accounts easier within the same year. The ban on opening more than one ISA of each type every year should be axed. Also in there, hiking dividend tax rates to the same level as income tax rates, and reviewing emergency tax rates on pension cash and early closure penalties on lifetime ISAs. So, Rachel, why do we need this?
I'm all for simplifying, but I interviewed Angela Knight, the chair of the Office for Tax Simplification, a few weeks ago, and she explained the difficulty, really, of any kind of tax simplification is that there's, if you start to line things up, which is what I think how they do their simplifying, then they're going to be winners and there are going to be losers. And the problem is when the losers end up being those you sort of most want to help. So it's a constant balancing act between complexity and nuance that might be essentially fairer, and lining things up, simplifying a bit more sort of broad brush strokes, but some people who shouldn't be paying more end up doing so. That said, they did look through the whole savings landscape, and a few things they said, that's a bit weird, that's a bit stupid, why do we do it that way? And one of them, which came, it seemingly is a huge revelation, although Simon's been writing about it for some years and there was also a report about it that came out a few weeks ago as well, was ISAs. ISAs are all over the place and complicated, and there are some real easy wins with ISAs. Why it is that you can only open one type of each type of ISA every tax year doesn't make sense at all. And every now and again, a chancellor will look at these weird rules that we have with things like ISAs and to great fanfare change them in a budget. We used to have some money was allowed to go in stocks and shares ISAs, some into cash ISAs, and you could move the cash ISA money into stocks and shares ISAs, but not the other way around. It was all ridiculous. So sometimes they do change these things. So I think there is hope that a chancellor, should they need something to announce that sounds cool, that doesn't cost them anything, ISAs is probably a good move.
Mm. George Osborne loved a good ISA, didn't he, Simon?
He did love an ISA.
He loved a good ISA.
And actually, we've seen the growth of the ISA system over recent years, and we've also seen the emergence of lots of new companies that do different things. And I think that that's why I called for this in the first place, is that, for example, you could have a company such as Hargreaves Lansdown, to name the biggest, where you invest your funds and shares and you pick your own funds and shares. And then you could have a company like Nutmeg, for example, where they manage the money for you. Now, it might be quite reasonably that you would want to spread your investment ISA across some funds and shares that you pick yourself, and you might want to try out this new service and get them to run some of your money for you. But at the moment, you can't do that. You can't pay money into those two things in the same year. So to me, that seems to be of detriment to the consumer and also detriment to new businesses and startups. The problem that I must admit I have with this Office of Tax Simplification report, however, is the stuff on dividends. So basically, they made this suggestion that the problem with dividend tax is it's a bit fiddly and it's a bit complicated. People might get confused by it. So maybe it should just be changed to the same rates as the income tax that mm-hmm. we pay. Now, there is a slight problem with this. One, dividend tax rates only just went up. And as a sop on that, there was this new dividend allowance introduced, which has only just been cut from £5,000 to £2,000. So people are already paying more tax on their dividends, having had the SOP removed from them. And also, on dividends, you are taxed at a rate of either 7.5%, 32.5%, or 38.1%. If it was brought into line with income tax rates, it would be 20%, 40%, and 45%. Did you notice anything about those numbers compared to the first set? They're all bigger, so you'd be paying more tax. I'm not sure whether the benefit of making things slightly less confusing for people justifies hiking the tax on the dividends that they receive. And there is a theory in why you pay less on your dividends is because by investing in a company, you are taking an entrepreneurial risk. You're putting money into something that could go wrong. And one of the rewards for taking that entrepreneurial risk is the dividend that they pay you. And you don't get that. You don't take that same entrepreneurial risk with your employment. you have a contract with your employer and your employer says that you do this and I will pay you this. So I think that maybe actually we should pay less tax on dividends. It's the same reason why we pay lower tax rates on capital gains than we do on income as well.
Thank you very much, Simon Lambert. Thank you very much, Rachel Rickard-Strauss. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our new junior ISA.